This is the Punk News Podcast, episode 259. Yeah, because America likes the way we swing. Adam White. John Gentile in Philadelphia.
Back in Philadelphia, out of Panera Bread. Thank goodness. I couldn't handle another slice of bread and crappy coffee.
John, this is episode 259.
That's cool, man. That's cool. That's
really important. Do you know why 259 is important?
Adam, why is 259 important?
Does it jump to mind why it's important? I mean, I don't know how obscure a reference this is or if it's just a personal obsession.
Well, let's see. It's 113 more than 138. Mm. No, my math is wrong. 121.
Sandinista, John. Hitsville, UK. The band walked in and knocked him dead in 2 minutes 59.
Mm. You got me on that one, although I do love Sandinista. That is a great album and an underrated album, mind you.
You know, I've always, like, for the life, for as long as I've been into music in a nerdy way, have been sort of obsessed with various Sandinista esoteria. And for some reason, I've been really obsessed with Hitsville UK. And to the point where, like, I own the domain 259.com, which I bought when I was, like, a university student. And at one point, it was like a crappy music blog that I had. And now it just goes nowhere, but I still own it because one day it's going to become something. But like that number is magical. The story behind that number, and I was trying to figure this out before we started the show because I wanted to actually tell the proper story behind this, and I cannot find the damn source. I thought it was in the Clash on Broadway box set, but it's not.
Great box set. Maybe the best punk rock box set there is.
If you have the tall box, it is, because it has a really cool book.
I do.
Yeah, but I thought it was in there, but I don't think it is. Where the story was that someone that was in the Clash's circle at the time, and I don't know who it was, and I thought maybe it was Cosmo Vinyl, but I can't find any proof of this, had an opinion that the perfect pop song was 2 minutes 59 seconds long, and that's why they wrote that into, you know, that's why they wrote that into Hitsville UK. And I went, and I've looked around, and I can't find the actual source on that, so I gotta dig now. It's gonna drive me absolutely crazy about who said that and why it became part of one of the weirder songs on one of the cooler Clash albums ever. So,
but if I may, Adam, you know, what's cool about Sandinista is it's got hidden messages all over it. Like, Adam, do you know the code for it, catalog number for it?
I do not know the catalog number off the top of my head.
It's like FSLN1, which is a reference to like the Sandinista revolutionary peoples. It's something in Spanish.
See, all of it, we should just change the whole format of this show. We can just talk about Sandinista.
What if we did a Sandinista like episode and we just like took a completely and you know, like the newspaper, which is really cool. You know, if you got to get the record because it comes with that gigantic newspaper called Armageddon Times, which is a reference to Armageddon Time, which they covered originally by Willie Williams.
You know what? I'm not going to delay the show by pulling my copy off the shelf and seeing if that newspaper is in there or not, but I will. Oh,
you got to buy a copy with the newspaper. It's so
I will
cool.
check. But my copy of Sandinista is a, like most of my Clash records, is a piece of vinyl that it comes from the prior period in my life where, like, now I will go buy vinyl because I am like an adult with disposable income and I can do so. And vinyl is a thing now. When I bought all my Clash records, vinyl was not a thing. I was just scrounging around at flea markets and things like that. So I have this like really greatly fucked up version of Sandinista that I'm pretty sure is bursting because, you know, you fit three records in a sleeve over the years, it's going to, you know, start to explode Nate out of there. Well, that's what's happening. And I'm wondering if it has the original liner notes with it. I don't know. I've got to look that up. Anyway, so John, it's just, okay, well, first question is, does someone want us to do an episode of this show that is specifically about Sandinista?
Like all we do for an hour is talk about Sandinista, investigate Sandinista, and maybe play some tracks.
Yeah, because I think we can do that. Anyways, yeah, so write us, podcast@punknews.org, and let us know if that would not make you unsubscribe, because we don't want that to happen. But yeah, so John, it's just you and me tonight. It's one of those John and Adam hours where we're just going to – we didn't even make a plan, John. We normally have a plan. At least we have like 5 or 6 stories that we know we're going to talk about. And
you know what's funny is we go on other podcasts once in a while and the people like plan their podcasts months in advance and they want like an outline of all the stuff we're going to talk about. And the Punk News podcast, we literally don't even plan at all. We show up and talk.
We have, you know, we'll accrue a list of stories we're going to talk about like a few hours prior. And, you know, hopefully everyone that's on the podcast has actually like listened to those songs or read those stories. And we know that that's not always really the case, but, even that amount of planning, for us is, I don't know, it's a nice safety net of structure. This time we're just out here in the wild. So
we're truly testing our skills. This is us truly as podcasters. Can we create entertainment out of nothing? I mean, anybody can make an interesting podcast. You know, when, I don't know, when Nick Oliveri is arrested with guns or when Laura Jane Grace announces a new album, it's easy to make conversation and news out of that. Can you and I make conversation and entertainment out of thin air? That is what tonight we'll be testing.
And now I'm going to play that 9-minute song off the new Titus Andronicus record to eat up some time. I love that there is a 9-minute song on this, like 2.5-hour record that... Not only is it packed with like 30 tracks of excess, that one of those tracks is like almost 10 minutes. It's the song he said where like the there's an S in brackets in front of the, I don't know how you're supposed to say it. It's either he said or he said she said or she said he said or the opposite of that. Anyways, it's cool. Oh, John, what are we doing tonight? What are we going to talk about?
All right, well,
what have you been up to, John? What's give the people a little bit of a backstory here. So you've been on the road, hanging out in strip mall parking lots, recording the podcast. what are you on the run?
Well, quite the opposite. I am running towards something. What happens was, as some of the listeners might know, I'm an attorney, and we had some pretty heavy duty litigation actually out in Harrisburg. Just because that's where the suit was filed, I'm not going to go into specifics, but it went very well for our client. And the short story is, we had a client where the bank, she had a mortgage, the bank sold her house, but the problem was that she was current on her mortgage, she was not behind, and the bank did not tell her that they sold her house, which is illegal. So we sued the bank, and it was long negotiations. I thought it was going to go to trial. So I was out here for a while doing research, and we had like 3 negotiations over 2 weeks, which is crazy. You usually have like 1 negotiation or 1 mediation over like every 6 months if you're going to do that. But we had it was a battle. It wasn't the baddest battle I've ever been in. The baddest battle I ever was in was probably like my second, that really built character. But this one was tough. The opposing counsel was good. I wouldn't say they were necessarily nice people or even people that were trying to do the right thing. Closing counsel was pretty tough, but we stayed firm and settled the case, which was good. But what was crazy is out here, there's so many subcommittees, you know, Harrisburg's capital of Pennsylvania. There's so many, like, subcommittees. Like, I don't even know who they are, but Pennsylvania has been talking about adopting some statutes similar to California. And so somehow word got out that I'm a California attorney. So they asked me to go in front of the subcommittee last week and like give my opinion on certain things as an attorney and as a mortgage servicing litigator, and I did, and it was super weird and super crazy. So I mean, 1 minute I'm talking about, you know, if Danzig is cool or not, and the next minute I'm arguing about obscure statutes with regards to post judgment interest and that kind of a thing.
See, that's one of those you definitely have to wear pants gigs.
Indeed, you gotta wear pants, you gotta wear a suit, a tie, you gotta look respectable, Adam. Respectable.
Mm. Well, I mean, I don't have any amazing story like that, but I wanted to bring up here because, I mean, you're the only person I can talk to about this because my wife doesn't care and my kids can't really talk about anything. I was up in Ottawa this past weekend, John, which was a little bit of a jaunt for us, but I had a conference on the Friday, snuck up there for that, and then I brought the whole family with me, and I used it to sneak out to some punk rock things that I was trying to get out to, and mostly failed, but I did buy some records. So Ottawa is not we talk about it a lot on the show because I like the music scene, but
what's Ottawa like? Is it like New York City? Is it like Austin? No, is it small? Is it big?
I don't know the population off the top of my head. It's probably I've got to imagine that like Ottawa is probably like a million people. Like it's not, it's you know, it's way bigger than the town that I live in, but it's you know, maybe a biggish town by Canadian standards, and the fact that it is our capital. But I don't know how really huge it is. It's by no means like a massive metropolis or anything like that. But it's, you know, it's got a lot of symbolic importance. There's probably a sizable number of people that are in Ottawa at any given time that don't really live there. You know, that's where all the politicians go and sit in a room and argue about stuff. And there's all the embassies and delegations and stuff. It's our Washington, D.C. for whatever that
it is. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's the capital of the country. So
I should know that.
You guys didn't know what Tim Hortons was last week, so I don't know what facts about Canada.
Well, you don't know what a Wawa is, Adam. Do you? You know what a Wawa is? Do you know what a Sheetz is?
I know not what the like so, on your bed. Yeah, all right. Anyways, so
you know what a 7-Eleven is though, right?
I know. Yeah, we know we have 7-Elevens. So
how about a 7-12?
No.
How about a 411? 138.
John. So we go to Ottawa, which by the way is a weird thing for me to travel to because it's the capital of my country. We have a highway that goes basically from where I live straight up to there, but the way that I get to Ottawa is I go through New York State. And the reason for this is that it is a more pleasant drive for me to cross the border south into the United States, go under Lake Ontario, and then up around Lake Ontario, where kind of like it's where the Thousand Islands are. I don't know what major cities around there.
Is that like where the Sal Justin comes from? The Thousand Islands, like that's the name.
Yeah, the Thousand Islands are in the St. Lawrence River. But basically, it's quicker for me to cross the border in like Buffalo or Niagara Falls, New York, drive to Syracuse, and then turn north, and then cross the border again there. And then go up into Ottawa, than it is to go through Canada to get there. Because to go through Canada, I have to drive through Toronto, which is a horrible thing to do. And we have this highway that goes kind of from crosses all of Ontario, but I would pick it up in Toronto, which is called the 401. And the 401 goes from Toronto to Ottawa, but Toronto to close enough. And it's the worst road ever, John. It is so boring. So I would much rather go through like customs twice then have to drive through Toronto to get there. So anyways, that's a side note. The punk rock stuff I was trying to do in Ottawa, I have become slightly obsessed with this venue that has opened in the last couple of years in Ottawa that I've only seen talked about online and I'd never been to, called House of Targ.
Mm.
And what House of Targ is they bill themselves as a pierogi and pinball joint. So they spend Monday and Tuesday, they are closed. And on Monday and Tuesday, they spend all of their time making gourmet pierogies to serve later in the week. And then I think like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they are open. They open at like 5 o'clock or so for a dinner service. So you can come in and get, I guess, apparently I didn't have any, but you can get some really kick-ass pierogies here. And then it is filled with like with vintage pinball machines.
That's cool.
And then after you come in and play pinball and eat your fantastic pierogies, it's a show venue. So it sounds totally amazing, and I wanted to go there so much, and I was really tempted just to like somehow ring them up and be like, hey, can I bring a toddler and a 2-year-old to your to your weird venue? But that didn't seem like something that I wanted to inflict on my family or the rest of the world. But I did drive by it twice, and it's one of these places where it's like, it's a door in the side of a building with a sign above it, and that's all you see because I think it's in the basement. And I'm just like, oh, I want to go in that place. And it's painted with like 80s like pinball machine space graphics and stuff all over the so I didn't get it to go there. And hell, I mean, the credentials here are that Radioactivity was playing there the Monday, and I was leaving on the Sunday.
Burn.
So, that keeps happening to me. So I wanted to go to House of Targ, couldn't go to House of Targ. Did drive by it, and that doesn't really win me any points.
Adam, what's your favorite pinball game?
I don't know. I haven't played pinball in a long time.
Oh, man, I love – my friend Dunk at Penn State. I went to college at Penn State. They used to have this awesome arcade right across the street from the college. And my friend Dunk and I would go every Sunday. We'd go get Taco Bell. Then we'd go play pinball. And we would play the Star Wars Episode One pinball, which even though the movie is crappy, the pinball game is amazing.
I want to say that we used to play a Terminator 2 pinball machine.
Yes, the Terminator Oh, man, that game is so good.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, so couldn't go to House of Targ. So I was like, all right, I'm in Ottawa. I really want to go back to a place called Gabba Hay. And Gabba Hay is a little record store that is adjoined to this I guess it's a recording studio that's in this industrial park. I think the recording studio is called Central City or City Central, or I don't remember off the top of my head. But back when the Arboretum Festival was happening, and I was up there to see the Constantines and a bunch of bands, I remember we finished our set in the big festival field, you know, and then I started running across town and then hailed a cab and had them bring me down to this Gabba Hay place. And the way that you get up to this venue, or at least the way that I got up to this venue, was to like go around this industrial building and then go up a fire escape. And then there were just a bunch of people hanging around. And like, this is like a, you know, one of these like massive buildings that's full of garage doors, you know, like industrial park kind of building, like not streetscape or anything like that. No real signage that I could see. And when I was there, that was where, who was playing that night? New Swears, which is a band I've talked about a lot in this show who I really love. So they're playing, Grays were there, the Dirty Nil were there. I forget who else was playing that show, but yeah, that was a cool show. And I know they had a little record store there, and I thought, hey, if I'm on this show talking about all these crazy, weird, you know, Ontario bands, this is the place where I can go and probably pick up all of the various, you know, stuff that I can't find in a more commercial record store that they've released. So I get up there and I walk in the door, and this guy's walking out at the same time, and he's like, hey, and I'm like, hey, and I walk in, and the store is closed. And there's, because the store is just like it's like a little closet room that's attached to the main recording venue. So I guess like the studio was open or something like that. This guy didn't seem to bat an eye that I was just like some like person who just like wandered in. So I don't know. So that didn't work. I did, you know, defeatedly wander back to my car and like pull up my phone and Google like record stores Ottawa and like found something that was actually down the street and around the corner and went there and did my shopping, John. So I have some conquests from my trip, but
what'd you get?
Didn't get to do what I wanted.
That is the worst though, when you're really looking forward to hitting the place and you get there and it turns out they're closed, even though like the website says they'll be open or something.
This was one of these places, like, I would almost expect them to be open not at normal times, just because they're not even a, like, they don't even have, like, a, like, there's no way you would know this was here unless you knew this was here. So I imagine that it has weird things. It was to the point where it was like, I just got to drive down there. I'm like, I didn't even want to bother looking to, like, phone them or something, because I'm like, I don't feel like this is the kind of place that has a phone.
Yeah,
So, you know, I went and I wandered and I bought some stuff. So here's what I've got, John. Now,
on a side note, Adam, let's talk about record stores and then you can talk. Do you prefer the tiny boutique record store that probably won't have a specific thing that you're looking for, but will have obscure stuff? Do you prefer the jumbo record store that has all the Devo record, any Rolling Stones record, any Clash record, that'll have all of that, but they don't have as much used stuff? Or do you prefer the dad record shop, which is medium size, that it's all used records, and who knows what you're going to find there? Which do you prefer?
I've had a lot more. I find I have a lot more fun lately. And this is, I think this is going to be a different answer than you. is that I'll have a lot more fun lately at sort of the small to medium sized store that maybe has like a mix of used stuff and new stuff, but doesn't really have everything. And I think that the reason behind that is that if I'm in a store that has like everything new possible, I kind of fall into this, well, I could just kind of close my eyes and spend money here, and that's not really any fun. Like, I may as well just be on Amazon buying records. Like, if I go into a record store and, like, they have, I don't know, like, I mean, I think I have them, but, you know, let's say every Clash record and it's new and shrink-wrapped. Like, I guess that's cool because, you know, someone needs those and, you know, my copies are fucked up. Maybe that someone is me. But at the same point, it feels a little bit too consumery for me to walk into a store and, like, go, okay, out of this bin, I could spend $400. And, you know, without really trying. I don't know. That doesn't feel – there's no hunt in that, you know? Like, there's no game. There's no sport. That's what I was going to say. That said, on the other hand, I've been in some super dingy shops where, like, everything feels wet.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't really – I don't know if I want to – like, there might be some gems hidden in these – bins full of dust mites and whatever, but I'm gonna be in here for like 10 minutes, and this being Canada, I'm gonna flip through like the same copy of like a fucking Trooper record like 17 times, and I'm just gonna feel dirty. So
honestly, I find that like those super crappy dingy record shops usually don't have anything good, and I don't know how they stay in business.
Yeah, I mean, some of them seem like it feels like the extension of someone's basement. Like they could live there.
Yeah.
Like they're somehow grandfathered in with like weird rent, and they just happen to maintain. Yeah, I don't know. But so anyways, yeah. So I don't know. I went and I did some record shopping. I didn't find anything rare. I keep digging. I have certain things that I'm always sort of digging around for. But I bought some new stuff that I'm quite happy with that I have sitting here in my hands right now. Some of this stuff, John, I think is right up your alley, too. I grabbed the new Screaming Females record.
Oh, yes, that is a good Rose Mountain.
Yeah.
That is a good record. The third track, Wishing Well, like that song, we'll play it later on in the podcast. That song, Wishing Well, moves my soul. You know, like Sam Cooke would, or like Funkadelic, or like some of the best Clash. That song, Wishing Well, makes me feel like I'm 3 feet above the ground. That is an amazing song.
And you know what? I was not sure about this one, and I've been listening to it a lot online, and it's just like grown on me, so I'm in. And it's one of those things where like I got the record, and there was a little 7-inch that was in there too. And that's
ooh, cool. you got the rare one. Adam, that is rare.
Yeah, so there's like a, what's in here? There's a demo for the song Hopeless on side B, and side A is the song Skeleton. So yeah, So yeah, there was, so I didn't know it was in there. It wasn't on the label or anything. I just like popped it out, and there was a little 45 hanging out in there. And I was like, woo, yay. Didn't know that was in. So yeah, is that rare, John? I didn't know.
Yeah, that's like the pre-first press. I would qualify that as semi-rare. So congratulations, Adam.
Yeah, so I was happy about that. Speaking of stuff that I think you and I are mutually fans of, I grabbed the new, apparently it is an EP. I thought it was an LP. The Ripe for Love record by Young Gov. Ben Cook have fucked up. And there was a sticker on here that says the new EP from, but I don't know. It always felt like an LP to me.
Yeah, it's like 8 songs and it's like 40 minutes, you know?
Yeah, that's LP. I don't know. I don't know why that is. I did grab the new Swears record, the one that I've been talking about on this show for like the longest time. The reason why and actually I did not pick it up in Ottawa. I picked it up at my USPO box driving out to Ottawa because I had ordered it from Dirt Cult because they're the ones that have finally released it in North America. But I have that, so that I'm happy to have that. I also grabbed the 7-inch of 7-inch single from Der Faden, who is a we may have talked about them. It's the new band of the frontman of a Sudbury, Ontario power pop act that was called Statues that everyone used to really like. I think Rob Seaton is his name. I'm probably butchering that, but anyways, it's his band, so that's cool. And then I had some mail, John. I got a 7-inch here that's a split between Modern Action and the Swingin' Utters, so that's kind of cool. I'm gonna I'm gonna check that out. But
I think that's I think that's technically for review, isn't it?
It is technically for review. And actually, I mean, speaking of this, and I was gonna wait and bring this up, but I don't know what else to do with it. So I hope they're cool with this. But those nuts at Modern Action Records, they really want me to review this Briefs box set that they released.
Yeah, they do.
So they really do. So they sent it to me, and I had it, and then I had like two kids, and I somehow didn't review it. But it's still sitting here. I have a Word doc with a really cool review that I'm writing for it. It'll come out at some point. But those dummies sent it to me again.
Oh, wow.
So now I have this 7-inch box set from one of my favorite bands twice, and I don't deserve really either of them because I keep failing at writing this review, but I don't really know what I'm supposed to do with the second set now. So, John, would it be totally inappropriate for me to give that away? Like to our listeners?
No, it would be very proper. I think we should design a mechanism so we can give it to our loyal, like our readers that are really into punk news. That's what I think. What do you think?
Okay, yeah.
This, right. This is not just some record. Like, this is a really cool thing.
Yeah, there's like 8 7-inches and a tape and a poster and all kinds of crazy shit in here. There's a pin in there. I don't know. It's great. Okay, anyway, so here's what's going to happen. There will be a contest on an upcoming episode of the Punk News Podcast. I don't know which one, where we're going to request some stunt, and that will gain you I will ship you the Punk News Podcast listener this really cool Briefs box set and then whatever other garbage I can put in the box with it. So that's coming. So yeah. So there you go. So John, before we move on, let's break up the monotony of people listening to me talk. This is the song Midnight Lovers by New Swears out of Ottawa, Ontario. Recently released in North America on Dirt Cult.
Yeah.
did I say that song was called Modern Lovers? It was called Midnight Lovers. But anyways, we're back. That was New Swears. I love them. John, what else we got to talk about? What's up?
I like how you didn't ask me what records I got, Adam. It's all about you.
John, what records did you get?
Well, I'll go quick because apparently I'm less important.
Yeah.
I got a record, or a CD rather, that I've been trying to get for about 12 to 13 years. Every single record shop that I've ever been to in the last 12 years, I've looked for the CD. I check for this CD about once a week on eBay, once a week on Discogs, and I finally got it. And so let's rewind. About 12 years ago, on the Rat Cage Records MySpace, I believe it was their MySpace, they said, we're selling a CD for some kind of benefit for Rat Cage Records. Adam, who was originally on Rat Cage Records?
Rat Cage Records, John.
The Beastie Boys in 1981.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And so they were selling a CD, a live Young and Useless set, which is Ad Rock before he was in the Beastie Boys, a live Reagan Youth set, and a live Beastie Boys set when they were a five-piece punk band. And so I sent him an email 12, 13 years ago. I'm like, oh, do you still have this? And he sent me an email back, said, yes, we do. Mail me a money order. This was before PayPal. And I kind of didn't because I was only like, what? Well, I was like 18, 17. That's not that young. But I mean, you know, when you're 17, 20 bucks is a lot of money, you know? And so I was worried about getting burned, so I didn't send for one. And sure enough, a couple of years later, I found out that it was legitimate and that the CD was long, long out of print. So for 12 or 13 years, I've been looking for this live Young and Useless, live Reagan Youth, live Beastie Boys CD. And about 2 weeks ago, I finally got a copy. And it's my White Whale CD. That is probably the CD that I want more than any other CD out there. And I finally track it down, and it's so rewarding and so – even though I didn't really do anything, I didn't really accomplish anything, it's really what record collecting is all about, and it's so much fun when you get those White Whale records.
That is amazing. So was it just something that popped up? Like I've never used like Discogs or any of those things to actually like go shop.
It was Discogs, and Discogs has this great function where it says, alert me when someone puts such and such record up for sale. And sure enough, it just popped up there, and the guy was selling it for 12 bucks. You could probably sell that on eBay for 200, maybe more. And it was just up there for 12 bucks, and I just snatched it right up, and I was thrilled. I was sure it was going to be a burn, but I'm like, for 12 bucks, I'll take the chance. And sure enough, it was legit OG copy from 1998 or whatever.
Wow. That's pretty special, John. That's
yeah,
pretty
man,
cool.
I was super excited. So, I mean, I don't know if I even have a White Whale record, because I used to have like two or three White Whale records. My first was an original CD press of Morning Glory's Whole World Is Watching, but I got that. I got the Beastie Boys CD, and I don't know, man. I don't know if there's any record out there right now that I'm desperately searching for. I mean, there's records that I want for sure, but I don't know if there's one right now that I really have to absolutely have. You know, and so record collecting is fun, people. If you're into it, it's fun. Adam, let's talk about some serious stuff here. Some heavy-duty business went down this past week or so. I was at This Is Hardcore Fest this past weekend. I saw the Cro-Mags. This is the fourth time I've seen the Cro-Mags. They were amazing. I mean, wow, the Cro-Mags really, like, I've seen Cro-Mags four times. First time was very good. Second time in Philadelphia, they honestly were okay, not great. Third time was in Santa Cruz. They were pretty good, not great. But maybe because it was This Is Hardcore Fest and they felt there was a competition, they went all out. The Cro-Mags kicked ass. After that, I saw the Misfits, or the quote Misfits, Jerry Only's son, and Eric Archie. And the weird thing about the Misfits was Adam, I don't know if you can explain this or not, is the Misfits had this a huge banner of the Crimson Ghost. And next to it, they had a giant set list. The set list was probably about 20 feet tall. Of the set list that they played that night, like hanging up behind them, like a banner, except for the giant set list wasn't 100%. It was like 98%. It was like 95% accurate, but it wasn't 100% accurate. Why would a band like hoist up a giant set list behind them? I don't know if that was an art piece or if it was a reference for the band or so people could take pictures of it. Like why would I couldn't fathom why a band would do that. That's weird, right?
That's super weird. I mean, like, the funny answer is that they're old and that they need to see what's going on.
But they had a smaller set list taped to the bottom of the banner that they were looking at.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, like, when I saw when I saw the Sex Pistols reunion tour that they did back in, I was, 2003 maybe, and they were in Toronto. Like, John comes on to stage and he has a bottle of whiskey in one hand that he didn't put down the whole night, and then in the other hand, and he had like a binder, like a three ring binder, like you'd bring to school, that he had like sitting in front of him that he kept leafing through as he was doing the show. That like, on the one hand, I'm looking at this and going like, are these the lyrics? Does he need a binder of all the lyrics? Like, that's super weird if he would, because you figure that like, if anyone has heard these songs 50 bazillion times and wouldn't need to know that, it'd be him. But I don't know. But yeah, that's the joke, I guess, is that they're old and they need the Cribs notes because they're gonna forget them. But giant set list posted on the wall. There's something that makes that almost sound hubristic to me. Like in a way they're being like, I don't know, like look at our amazing catalog of hits. Like, I don't know.
I honestly didn't know the purpose of it. If you go in the Punk News Facebook, you can actually see a picture of it and look yourself. As for the Misfits, I mean, you know, I'm still not a huge Misfits fan these days. You know, I mean, new Misfits. But they played about 35 songs, and they did give it their all. So you can factor that however you want. You know, I mean, it's not really the Misfits, but the guys playing the music really did give 100%. So I don't know. I mean, it wasn't terrible, you know. But meanwhile, there was a bit of... Oh, and actually, I'm going to tell this story real quick, too. Outside of This Is Hardcore Fest, it was like a shopping mall. There was like 30 to 40 vendors. Well, the funny thing was, there's a lot of record sellers, but they were all selling the same like 20 hardcore records. Like if you go to like a punk rock festival or whatever, and there's record, like they'll have Bowie, they'll have punk rock, they'll have hip hop. But at the hardcore record festival, at the hardcore music festival, it's all hardcore records. There's no other records for sale. But and it really is like a shopping mall. Like people are like getting all these shirts. They're like, oh, fashion. I'm not dissing it. I'm just saying that punk rock isn't, and hardcore especially, is incredibly fashion conscious now more than ever. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's how it is. On a side note, Adam, not to keep getting off. You know, Adam,
we don't have a track.
Yeah, well, true. I'm trying to get somewhere, but I keep thinking of cool things that I want to talk about. Adam, when you went to a punk rock show 10 years ago, who would be there?
10 years ago? So what?
I'm going to say most of the people there, were they males or females?
I would say that 10 years ago, I'm thinking that you would probably see a lot of males, and you would probably see a lot of males in the, at least where I'm from, we were still sort of all, there's this like Californian pop punk fashion thing that was happening where everyone's wearing like shorts and a band shirt. Yeah.
If you went to a punk rock show in Philly 10 years ago, 92% males, 8% females, maybe less. Some shows 100% males or 99.9% males. This Is Hardcore Fest, 60% male, 40% females. So I think that's at least good in that punk rock, or at least hardcore, is becoming more integrated. And actually punk rock, not hardcore, punk rock shows in Philadelphia are almost like 50-50 these days. So that's good. If you go to a punk rock show in Philadelphia, a lot of girls in bands, maybe 40%, maybe 50% of the girls in bands, which is cool. At This Is Hardcore Fest, almost no girls in bands, but a lot of girls in the audience. So I'm not sure what that says necessarily.
Hmm.
So anyways, but I think that's good that hardcore is now more female inclusive than it used to be. So gradual steps. Though I will say all the women there were younger women. So I think that like you didn't see girls my age or older there that, you know, that weren't at the show 10 years ago. It was girls that are like 20, 21, 22 that were there. So I guess the younger generation is just more gender inclusive. But also they had porta potties there, and one of the porta potties had broke open and leaked human waste, and like a mixture of human waste and that blue bleach they put in porta potties. And the kids were lined up around it, Adam. And the kids were daring,
like lined up around it, like paying attention to it, or just they happened to be standing near it?
No, they were like, they were surrounding it like it was a pool. And they were and they were daring each other to like jump in it, and some kids jumped in it and like rolled around in it, and that was really gross.
So all of the you just advanced the hardcore community by saying they're more inclusive to women, and now you have degraded the hardcore community by saying they were literally rolling around in shit.
Well, listen, there's kids make dumb decisions. If the worst thing that those kids did was roll around, well, that's pretty bad. I mean, I'm not defending that. You know, kids are idiots. Kids in groups are idiots. And actually, it was mostly guys. And you get a bunch of guys around, and they're all thinking about girls, they start doing dumb things. Kind of like when you get a bunch of like male apes in a room, they're all looking for the girls. So they all start beating each other up and stuff. You know, so it was pretty gross. But speaking of, well, here's what I've been leading to. A band called Chokehold played This Is Hardcore Fest. Adam, do you know who Chokehold is?
I'm not aware of Chokehold. They're not a band that I knew about.
I didn't know a whole lot about them either. I think I had heard the name, but I didn't know anything about them. Well, in the 90s, Chokehold was a hardcore band, but one of those like really hardcore bands where it's almost like heavy metal. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And they're an extremely vegan, extremely straight edge, extremely anti-police band. So they're like uber vegan bands. You know, I don't think they're hardline, but they're extremely pro-social rights, that kind of a thing. You know, like Minor Threat to the nth degree. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so they just got back together for This Is a Hardcore Fest after, I don't know, maybe 10 years, 15 years, maybe even 20 years. Actually, I think closer to 20 years. And so before This Is Hardcore Fest, they played their first show as a band back together up in Toronto. Well, here's what happened at the show. The guitar player, he's a guy called Beckman, he's introducing a song, and here's what he says. Pigs take advantage of their authority and their power. And it's not just with black people. It's not just Black Lives Matter. There were effing three slangs in Hamilton alone last year at the hands of police on white people. So it's not just an effing racial thing. This is everywhere. Then, out of the audience, a person yells, "Cool racist shit, Grandpa." So Beckman replies, "What? You're calling me racist?" And then the person replies, "Yes, I'm saying police violence disproportionately targets black communities." So then Beckman, and this is, I'm reading it as if it's calm. They're kind of like yelling at each other, you know. So Beckman says, "It targets every community. I don't know what the F you're saying to me, mother effer." And then the person says, "Okay." And then Beckman says, "Okay, what?" And then the person says, "Okay, I'm saying you're voicing off some white supremacist shit." So Beckman says, I'm saying white supremacist shit. What the F are you talking about?" And then the person says, "Because you're minimalizing the impact of police violence on black communities. That's effing racist." And then Beckman says, "Who the F are you talking to?" And then the person says, "I'm not saying you're a horrible person, but..." And then I'm not sure, because I was not there and I researched this, but I think this is the point where Beckman takes a swing at the person, and I think he missed, although he might have hit the person, I'm not sure. So he takes, and I think this, he might have taken a swing after this, but I think right at this moment he took a swing at the person. And then he says, "I'm saying this isn't an issue of white or black, this is an issue of effing pigs. And if that dude comes in again, I'll effing kill him." And then they played the song, and the crowd was chanting ACAB, that kind of a thing. So, however, here's what turned out. It turns out that the person that was speaking was a transgendered woman named Sadie, who is in a band as well. So after the performance, you know, punk rock, I mean, especially hardcore is so, I don't know how to... It dissects itself so much. So after the show, people were saying that Chokehold was racist and transphobic because the lead singer took a swing at this Sadie person. Chokehold's reissues just came out on A389 Records, a great record label down there in Baltimore. So they posted the following Facebook message. "Punching a heckler in the face who visually appears to be male, but unbeknownst to you, identifies as transgender female does not make you a transphobe, homophobe, or woman beater. It makes you a hothead in an unfortunate situation. Saying it's not just Black Lives Matter, it's all lives matter, in a specific speech about abusive authority figures having the power to go after whomever they please, whenever they please, does not make you a racist. The amount of rallying by people who didn't research the situation before posting their opinion is far more alarming to me than a guy hitting a person he thought was another guy for calling him a Nazi grandpa. Call chokehold out for reacting violently if you must, but at the end of the day, that's the only valid allegation anyone can make towards the situation. I respect anyone's opinion on the punch, whether it's for or against it, but it ends there. And A389 is run by a guy called Dominic Romeo, or Dominic Romeo. And we interviewed him once. I like Dom a lot. I think he's a great guy. And PR-wise, he handled this very well. For some reason, you know, in these situations, people, you know, go off the deep end, but he was able to actually have genuine discourse with people that disagreed with him and whatnot, which amazed me, because in punk rock that can be so difficult to do because people are so vitriolic or charged up in punk rock. So if you ever want to see, you know, good PR, go check out that Facebook in that scenario. So there's a lot to unpack here, and the main issues are: is it okay for, well, stepping aside, putting this whole issue aside, speaking purely on violence at a punk rock show or a hardcore show, is it ever okay for a man to hit another man? Next question is, if a man hits someone that they think is a man but is a woman, does that make them transphobic? And why, I guess those are the... Oh, and is the band saying all lives matter, not just Black Lives Matter, racist? And I've got a lot of opinions on this, but I think maybe, Adam, I'll throw the ball to you first and we can respond. Is it ever okay for a man to hit another man? Is it okay for a man that's assigned male at birth to hit another man that's assigned male at birth that still identifies as male? Is that okay to do?
It's crazy how we have to parse language sometimes to make sure we know which, you know, what scenario we're talking about.
I hear you, but I don't want to get caught in this ram jam myself. You know what I mean?
No, so I'm being very specific. So, I mean, it's funny because I'm sure that I have joked on this show when we've been talking about some people that have been dicks. Actually, I joked about this when we talked about the story in which I believe there were some Nazis showed up at a street dog show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, and I made some sort of glib comment about, well, someone should just punch that guy in the nose, and then you actually you picked it up and you said, you know, maybe we shouldn't all just be slugging each other. And I think in real life that would be more what I would subscribe to. I'm the kind of person that's never been in like a physical fight with anyone, and I don't think that I would have like the constitution to actually make that happen. So at least as far as like Adam in real life, no, I wouldn't bring any harm onto another person. I can't. And I guess if I really think about it, and I'm not joking about punching Nazis or anything like that, I don't think that I would hit anyone in most cases. Like, that's not a self-defense case. I don't really see what that solves. So and I've never been the kind of person where, you know, I felt that I need to somehow, like, I don't know, defend my honor by getting in a bar fight with someone. So that's clearly not in my character. So I'm gonna go, no, you probably don't need to hit anyone in any scenario that you're not like physically threatened or something like that. So I'm gonna go that one on that point, John. No hitting. I have two kids now. No hitting.
I'll actually disagree with you a little bit, Adam. And I think if you're in a scenario where someone really, basically, I don't know, like tries to offend your inherent core or whatever, and is just being a real asshole, or is being a real prick, or showing you if someone is showing you an extreme amount of disrespect, I think it actually is okay to hit somebody, another guy in that situation, if he's not like clearly physically weaker than you. Like, you can't go around beating up little guys, you know. But if someone's being a real asshole, I think it kind of is okay to hit them if you're willing to put that on the table.
To me, that would seem like it would ascribe a certain amount of power to the person that you're hitting. Like, you've let them get so far under your skin that you have no recourse other than to, like, I don't know, like that, you know, step out of being like a human being and try to smush them.
Listen, I've gotten in, outside of rugby, I've gotten in 3 fist fights in my life, and I'm glad I did all 3 of them. I wouldn't now because, I mean, especially in the punk rock scene, because people kind of know who I am. So if I hit anybody, and actually last year, I wanted to hit a guy really bad, but I didn't. And because if I did, they would sue me just because I'm me. You know what I mean? So my fighting days were over. But I was actually at an effed up show once, and Trash Talk was opening. And and there was a girl in English, she was from England, and she went to law school with us, but then she was back in England, but she was out for about a month. So I took her to an effed up show, and we were hanging out back by the bar, nowhere near the mosh pit. And this guy who thought he was tough does the thing where you run through the mosh pit through people and just smash into people like that aren't even moshing. And he hit her like really bad and then ran off. And so what I did is I waited till he circled around the mosh pit again. And then I charged him and I smashed him against the side of the stage, and then I hit him in the face once or twice, and then I got drug out the venue. But I was glad I did it. And so the point being is that sometimes I think I don't necessarily think we live in a just world. So I think in rare circumstances, sometimes that's necessary to give someone their just desserts, because otherwise they will never get their just desserts. And I think that's immoral to let that person just act poorly without suffering the consequences.
Okay, I can't argue with the case that you put together. So is it ever justified if you are a stage performer?
No. Oh, wait, and you hit someone in the audience?
Yeah.
I would, as long as they don't physically assault you, probably not. However, let me put a corollary on that. In punk rock now especially, everything's so black and white. Either you're acting correctly or you're acting incorrectly. And if you do something bad, then you're the worst person ever. I think if someone's heckling you horribly, like Adam, let's say you're on stage, and Adam is not racist. Adam is one of the most culturally inclusive people I know. If Adam's on stage and someone goes, "Adam, you're a Nazi, Adam, you're a Nazi, Adam, you're a Nazi," and Adam jumps off the stage and hits a guy, I think he probably shouldn't do that, but I don't think that's that bad of an infraction. Whereas opposed to if someone was just, you know, like wearing a shirt of a band he didn't like, and he jumped off stage and hit that person, I would say then Adam White is a bad person. He shouldn't do that. But if Adam White jumps off the stage and hits a guy that's calling him a Nazi, I would say that's a forgivable sin and easily forgivable. But you still shouldn't do it.
Mm. All right. So coming past the initial punch here. So all right. So it is maybe okay in some scenarios to hit a guy who is clearly, I guess, identifying as a guy. So
that's my stance.
So all right, so we've got that. So then the question is this guy being transphobic for striking this person that turns out to be trans?
My answer is no. I would say no if he genuinely thought the person was male. However, a website that I'm not gonna quote because I didn't like a lot of things they said, they did have this thing that it's hard to argue around, and I'm not sure that you can. The logical conclusion of their reasoning being, if the woman doesn't pass to her assaulter, then the man can't be blamed for attacking her as if she was a man. And that is a real problem, you know? I certainly don't think the ban's transphobic, because, yeah, here's how I can answer this. The ban certainly is not transphobic, because transphobic implies intent. That is, if you're transphobic, it means you intend to hurt somebody because they are transgender. Here, he didn't even know the person was transgender. He thought it was a man. So you can't say he's being transphobic because he didn't have that intent, you see.
You know what? I could go with that. I didn't get the impression from the way that this story was relayed by you to me now that
quote that my facts might be wrong. This is just what my research came up. But if we do have the facts wrong, please let us know, because I'm not standing behind these facts 100%. because I took these all off blogs, and you know how blogs are.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't sound like this altercation came about because the one party was trans. So, you know, I'm willing to give that. I think the more interesting question is the, or at least to me, only because I feel like I've read about this recently, is the Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter thing. I don't know about you.
For some reason, I found that to be the least concerning issue, but I mean, I've got a definite opinion on that. Do you want me to give my opinion, or do you want to give your opinion first?
Well, I mean, I want to say it's interesting because I don't think it's actually a substantive debate. I think it stems from people not properly parsing the phrase.
Exactly. And also, it's people taking an implication when there is no implication to be had.
Yeah, or flip it. They're leaving off the implication that they should be reading into it. So we probably have the same opinion on this, which is basically when people are saying...
Adam, isn't it funny how we both neither of us gave our opinion, but we gave vague allusions as to how we came to our opinion.
Yeah. I don't know. It's anyways. So yeah, when people are saying Black Lives Matter, what they're really saying is Black Lives Matter too. Like, Black Lives Matter as well, and, you know, should be ascribed the same justice as the rest of society, but they leave all of the rest of that off, so they just say Black Lives Matter. If you say that, like, well, what about All Lives Matter? You're completely dismissing the implicit part of the phrase that says that there are problems that this specific group has that the rest of society doesn't. So I don't know. Like, to me, it's people taking the grammar and trying to parse it to make a point that the original statement's not trying to make. I read a really good description of this. If anyone wants to kind of wade into the shitstorm, that is Reddit. And I went and I just looked it up because I remember I read it the other day, and it was quite a succinct way of putting this. Someone went into the Reddit Explain Like I'm 5 subreddit, which is where people just ask questions and want people to explain things to them. And they asked, you know, why is it controversial when someone says All Lives Matter instead of Black Lives Matter? And the person that actually broke down the answer did it in a really nice, succinct way that a lot of people that had actually had read it. I keep saying Reddit, and the site is Reddit, and I get it. But a lot of people that had commented on this had said, like, whoa, you've actually changed my mind about this phrase. So it's a neat thing. I'll link it up in the show notes. But anyways, John, am I off base here? Are we on the same?
I think we're on the exact same base, except for I will defend the band. When the guy was saying All Lives Matter, the speaker was saying that by saying All Lives Matter, he was implying that there isn't a disproportionate amount of wrongful killings on black people. When I don't think the guy in chokehold was saying that, I think all he was saying is that all lives matter equally, and that race truly doesn't matter. When someone gets wrongfully killed, or even killed with cause, it's still like, you know, I don't think he was saying, quote, black people are bringing too much notice to the issue. I don't think he was saying that at all. I think he was saying truly all lives matter.
Well, and his problem here, and this is where you get into really like hair splitting, is that like all the people that are on Twitter and the internet and arguing about the All Lives Matter thing, they're not taking that point. They're taking the black people are getting uppity, you know, point. And so for him to go and to use the same phrase and to, you know, maybe even use it in a way that you could argue is justifiable just brings in the implications of everybody that's using the All Lives Matter phrase in a way that is not justifiable, and it lumps you in with those people. So that's sort of a dumb thing to hitch your wagon to in the first place.
Indeed, but I would say again, that's a forgivable sin, and certainly doesn't prove that he's a racist, as some people were trying to say.
What it proves is that perhaps when you're a punk band and you're on stage, you shouldn't trying to be debating intense social issues in between your songs.
Oh, I disagree with that, Adam. I think the punk rock space is the exact place to do those kinds of things.
No, I mean, I'm just saying, like, do it through your art. Don't do it through, like, making, like, a potentially ill-delivered speech in between a song that then gets you in a fight with someone in the crowd. There might be a better way to use the fact that you're a band to, you know, make those issues of those viewpoints known than it is just to, like, you know, blast through a song and then, you know, blavoid on stage for, that's not the right way to say that word, you know, just sit there and toot your horn on stage for a while and then play another song. Like, I don't know. Whenever I've seen political bands that I felt have done it well, yeah, there might be a little bit of banter about the causes that they're singing about, but they're singing about them, I think, more than they're lecturing about them in between songs. And I always feel that, like, to me at least, unless you're dealing with someone in one of these bands who is incredibly well-versed, an incredibly eloquent speaker, it always sort of falls flat when they're doing that, you know, in between song politicking. I don't know. Like, I'm totally fine with them taking the message, but, you know, them being musicians, I'd like to hear that message delivered in a musical way.
I might disagree with you a little bit there, Adam. And I might say that art need not be practiced. Art need not be structured. Art need not be have a forethought. Some of the most wonderful art is certainly spontaneous. And when I say art, I mean music, I mean speeches, I mean whatever. So when a band gets on stage and the adrenaline's running through them and they say something that maybe in retrospect was in poor taste or not well thought out, us, the audience, should give them a fair amount of rope to, you know, crawl back up from whatever hole they fell down in, because as fans, we demand extraordinary art. Part of extraordinary art is spontaneity. And so it's unfair to damn a band for using spontaneity when it can be a thing of greatness and a thing of horribleness. So if a band missteps, I don't think we should do what happens quite a lot in the past 2 or 3 years in punk rock, and just crucify the band. I think we should give the band deference when they do something they may not have done, and say, well, that's the shrapnel, or that's the cost of having art, is that sometimes the artists might do kind of things maybe they shouldn't do. That's okay, as long as they grow from it or continue making good art, then I'm willing to excuse a certain level of infraction. That being said, if someone got up there and said, you know, I hate black people or I hate whatever, that's lame. But when someone says something that's either misconstrued or maybe not that well thought out, but anyone could say or most people could say just by blurting out without thinking about it, I'm entitled to give the artist deference, and I don't want to require artists to always be structured or know exactly what they're going to do on stage before they get on stage.
Oh, this whole thing plays in to Yoko Ono here.
Oh.
So on this show a few episodes ago, I took the fact that Ricky Frankel misspoke about something about the White Album to concoct this whole thing about how, like, Ricky has never heard the White Album, which I don't think was actually true. But then as part of this weird conversation we went into, I was trying to defend Yoko Ono a little bit as an actual artist and not just as, like the mustache twirling villain of the Beatles saga. but then Yoko tweets the other day, after I'm trying to defend her validity as an artist, she goes and she tweets something like, take a pane of glass, drive a nail into the middle of it, mail the shards to anonymous people.
It was mail the shards to mail each shard to a different address.
Yes, mail each shard to a different address. So, which is, like, is A, the kind of thing that a crazy person does, and B, is one of those things that, like if you had to come up with a jokey, you know, haha, isn't art stupid thing to ascribe to someone to do, that would be it. It was like when Yoko appeared on The Simpsons and she goes to Moe's and she orders, like, a single plum floating in perfume served in a man's hat. And then Mo just pulls it out from under the bar and gives it to her. But, like, it's that kind of, like, like, isn't this, you know, stupid art for the sake of art crap? And then she's talking about mailing shards of glass to people. So, you know, I can't really defend that.
Adam, tell the people about how I initially interpreted that saying.
Oh, you were trying to, like, oh, does no, this...
But I wasn't even trying. I wasn't even trying to. Like, that's how my brain read it.
Your brain read it as that was some sort of metaphor, like she was the nail and the Beatles were the shards.
That's what I thought she was saying. Like the phrase was, take a pane of glass, drive a hammer through it, and mail the shards each to a different address. And I read that as if some, like, take a unit as a whole and then split it up so each thing can go on its own journey. You know what I mean? And I was way off on reading that. Like,
I don't know. All I know is that if I go and I go get my mail and I open it up and it's full of broken glass, I'm going to think, like, isn't this a profound art statement that someone is making? I'm going to go, like, I hope there's no anthrax in here, and let's go call the police now, because this is what bad people do.
Well, you know, speaking of bad people, and by bad people, I mean wonderful people, let's play a Screaming Females track. This is off Rose Mountain. I love this song, and it's called Wishing Well, out now on Don Giovanni Records.
John, we're back. That was Screaming Females. I'm so looking forward to spending some time with this LP.
Great live there. Great live.
Is there anything? I mean, should we do the normal thing? Is there anything on punk news that happened that we really need to address? I mean, we you know, nothing necessarily that I think was an amazing story out of this past week. We learned the title of the Nightbirds record, which is fucking cool. So if you want to write this down in your calendar, the new Nightbirds record is going to be called Mutiny at Muscle Beach.
Great title.
Just a great title. It's out on October 2nd. There was a Pill video that came out, is them putting together that Double Trouble song. And it's actually like some footage of them recording, it's a weird little fly in the wall sort of video. Like aside of like the music video stuff that it's doing, it's interesting to see. To me, it's interesting to see like John Lydon like working with other human beings and being happy about it. So you know that was kind of neat. But I don't know what else happened. This was a slow week.
Slow week, man. Slow summer week. Now let me take a quick look. I know. Let's see here. Integrity announced a show down in Baltimore in September. I'm going to that for sure. And actually the Strange Noise Project, which no one knows who is in it, Vermapyre, is playing a show earlier on in the day, and I'm going to that. I think that might be like the first USA Vermapyre show ever. You can check them out on the Punk News mixtape. And other than that, man, we streamed the Earth Girls new EP, which is pretty good. And that's about it, man. Not a whole lot of news this week, honestly.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those weeks. So John, what do we do now? What do we do? We don't have a show. We don't have a structure. I'm flailing here.
Well, I mean, we kicked it for an hour and 10 minutes. That's pretty good, you know.
Is this where we normally end?
Yeah, I mean, we're at an hour. Well, an hour 5 without music, but with music, about an hour 10, hour 15.
Oh God, John, I don't even know what to do. Like I should do some tap dancing and.
I love the song "Putting on the Ritz." I think that's a good song.
Probably shouldn't play that. It's kind of against the brand.
Put on the Ritz?
Yeah. So anyways, I guess that's your show. That is the Punk News Podcast for this week, episode 259. Huge number of historical significance if you're me. So yeah, if you want to write us, podcast@punknews.org is how you write us.
And should we do the All Sandinista episode?
Should we do the All Sandinista episode? And then I guess another question would be, if you actually listened to this point in the podcast and you haven't turned it off, like 45 minutes ago, then, I mean, God bless you. But, if you get this far, do you like these kind of things? Like, do you like these kind of just like John Adam chill shows? I mean, like we like them because it's not a lot of work to put them together or anything, but,
and it's completely self-congratulatory.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about how great we are. I don't know. Do you like these as opposed to kind of like the normal three host thing we do? I'm curious. You know, just seeing who can fire, get off payroll, all that. So yeah, there we go. I guess we'll see you guys at 260. Because America likes the way we swing. MCs, you like the way we swing. Because Africa likes the way we swing. MCs, you like the way we swing. 'Cause down in Australia, they love the way we swing. MCs, you like the way we swing. Yo, 'cause Zimbabwe likes the way we swing. MCs, you like the way we swing. 'Cause over in the Philippines, they love the way we swing. Yeah, MCs, you like the way we swing. Don't you know the UK, y'all, likes the way we swing. MCs, huh, you like the way we swing. Even in Cleveland, they like the way we swing. MCs, you like the way we swing.